Okay, thank you. Okay, so it's a pleasure to be giving this kind of more general lecture, and it's always interesting to speak to a broad audience about one's work. I got here a little bit early so I could write some things on the board. You don't have to know what these molecules are. They may be in the food that you're eating for lunch, or they may be on the box tops, on the packages that you have for all kinds of things at home. But we're all familiar with structures like this, if not from high school chemistry, then from other places. These are simple diagrams of molecular structures. And the question that I want to start off with is by posing the following question. If we take a complicated molecule, and I should say, since this is a broad audience, if you think about the nuclei and the electrons of these things, you can think about them as solar systems, right? So don't think of it as chemistry. Think about it as nuclei that are moving with electrons that are orbiting, and these are actually very, very interesting dynamical objects. And what we want to do is we want to take these dynamical objects, and we're asking the question, is it possible to come in with laser light and to break this chemical bond, or let's say to break this bond. This is, as you can see, it's a double bond, so this is in general harder to break than a single bond. So can we selectively cleave this bond or cleave this bond? So that would be controlling dissociation with light. A molecule like this is known to twist, or what we call isomerize. So is it possible to design, come in with laser light, and to control whether or not this molecule twists or twists back? Here's a molecule that has a ring structure here. And this is... the question is, can we come in with light and selectively cleave this bond or this bond or this bond? Can we get the ring to open in different ways? And so I think each of you can bring your own theoretical tools to this kind of problem. But what we have here is some kind of solar system with nuclei and electrons orbiting around. We have the potential to come in with light, which is our control. And the question is, what can we actually do? If we can actually control the outcome of chemical reactions as we wish, then it opens up an entirely new way of doing chemistry, which has all kinds of implications for clean chemistry and for cheaper chemistry and so forth. So it's a very simple question to ask, and we're just beginning to learn the answers. I want to say that, let me just talk for a minute about the time scales, since I think one of the things that, in order to put us all on the same page, since people here may be dealing with very different time scales, the nuclei are much heavier than the electrons, at least 2,000 times up to about 200,000 times. And so the time scale for nuclear motion is typically 10 to the minus 13 seconds. So this is the regime of femtoseconds. The electrons move 2,000 times faster or more. This is the typical time scale for electron motion, and 10 to the minus 18th is attosecond time scale. Molecular rotations are slower. They're typically between 10 to the minus 13th and 10 to the minus 10th seconds, and this brings us down to the picosecond time scale. And nuclear spin, which has a very small splitting and therefore very long time scale, is typically controlled in an external magnetic field. You get a larger splitting, and then one is typically dealing with time scales on the order of microseconds or sometimes up to nanoseconds. And these are the corresponding, every community has its own favorite energy units, but here I think EV is fairly standard. So these are the energies in EV that we're talking about. So in principle, all these processes are going on in molecules, and in principle, we can try to use any of these processes as a handle with which to control the molecular motion and potentially the bond breaking. Now, I want to say that the laser was invented in 1960. And I was a graduate student in 1980 when an article came out in Physics Today with it was the cover article, and it asked the question, laser selective chemistry, is it possible? So here it was 20 years after the invention of the laser, and people didn't know the answer to whether or not it was possible to control the outcome of these reactions using laser light. That was 1980, and I would say that what we've seen in many fields in atomic and molecular and optical physics in 1980, 1990, and until this day, is an increasing number of applications where there's a shift of a paradigm from passive to active. In other words, if you do spectroscopy, and you measure what frequencies light absorbs, and then you use this, let's say, as a probe of the structure of molecules. And I think in many fields, spectroscopy is used as a probe. This would be called passive. But if you then take the exact same physics, you can turn it around, and you can say that that same light that you put in to probe a molecule could be used to control the molecule. Then that becomes an active viewpoint. And if we think about many exciting developments, probably the most exciting developments in AMO physics since the 1980s, we've seen fascinating work on laser cooling. So laser cooling, in a certain sense, is an active viewpoint. Then we use the laser in order to actively cool things down. Creation of Bose-Einstein condensation. You have a well-defined target and you're trying to make it. This, again, is an active kind of viewpoint. Quantum computing is an example where you're not probing the system. You're trying to get a desired outcome. And quantum control is one of these exciting developments of the last 20, 25 years, which has an active viewpoint in some sense. If quantum control doesn't have something to say about all these other areas, then we probably don't know how to do it properly yet. Okay. Okay, so I want to start with some very simple pictures. Let's start with just a diatomic molecule, two atoms. And I'll come back to this a little bit later, but I heard a lecture by Arthur Shallow where he said a diatomic molecule is a molecule with one atom too many. Okay, so let's take H2 molecule. There are two protons and two electrons. Okay, so here's that's our solar system. Or if we take oxygen, we all need oxygen to live. 16 protons, 16 electrons. And in the most...
8 protons.
In the molecule.
Okay.
Sorry. And in the and in the most common form, 16 neutrons. I don't know that much chemistry, but I checked this before. Okay. Now, so in high school we learned that the distance between these atoms is on the order of 1 times 10 to the minus 10th. Meters, all right, or angstroms, but then, you know, on a, one begins to wonder: are these things literally frozen, or can they vibrate? And what about the electrons in this process? Can we create some kind of state that's electronically excited? And if we do, then the vibration, then the electronic excitation can lead to vibrational motion, or it can lead to dissociation. So these processes this is in a certain sense a coupling between the electronic motion and the nuclear motion. By nuclear motion here we mean the internuclear separation, and the coupling between these plays a very important part in all of molecular physics. So these are the basic processes that we're going to start thinking about. And let me show you now the cartoons that people in theoretical chemistry or physical chemistry or molecular physics like to draw. So what's normally drawn is a potential energy function as a function of the internuclear separation. Now, where this has the minimum is what we learn in high school is the internuclear separation. But this shows that the molecule has some kind of potential energy as a function of internuclear separation. If the atoms get far enough apart, then the potential energy reaches some kind of asymptote. And the difference in energy between this and this is the bond energy. That's the energy that it costs to break a chemical bond, or the energy that's gained in bringing two atoms together from infinity. The potential goes to infinity as the distance goes to zero, and we're leaving out weak and strong forces and so forth, but this is just from the fact now of the electrostatic Coulomb repulsion of the nuclei. Okay, so this is the typical starting point. And when we start to think, where does a curve like this come from? Well, I don't have time to go into where exactly it comes from, but this is some effective force field that takes into account the internuclear repulsion as well as the average location of the electrons. And so what one does now is one can now think about the quantization of the energy levels in this potential. And in particular, one has a function which looks very close to Gaussian, which is the lowest vibrational state of this potential energy surface. So this represents the distribution of separations around the average of the two nuclei in the lowest vibrational state when a molecule is stable. Okay. All right. Now, so vibration corresponds quantum mechanically to some kind of excitation here, either time independent or time dependent. But I want to pass to the electronic excitation. To study electronic excitation, we draw two curves. And I'll give here two examples. Now, this corresponds to a ground electronic state. And this to an excited electronic state. And what I've done here along with the entire theoretical chemistry community, at least to zeroth order, is to say that because the nuclei are thousands of times slower than the electrons, there's an adiabatic separation of time scales. The electrons are so much faster that we can think about averaging over the electronic motion and getting adiabatic potential energy curves corresponding to different states in which the electron is. And then, if we start in the ground electronic state, and we excite, here's our optical excitation, then this goes back to James Franck in 1925, Frank and Condon. Frank said, let's take this idea that the nuclei are much slower than the electrons, let's take it one step further. And he said that the nuclear position and velocity don't change when we make the electronic excitation. So we keep the same shape of the nuclear wave function when we have an electronic excitation. Now here, now in the Frank, this is called the Frank-Condon principle. And although Frank won the Nobel Prize in 1925, and he discovered this in the year 1925. So he didn't win the prize for this, but this was in a certain sense a large part of his contribution to molecular physics. Now, in the usual view, one looks at the overlap of this state with the different vibrational states here, and that's what gives you that those overlaps as a function of energy predicts what's called the vibronic absorption spectrum. So it's vibronic because it's the coupled vibrational electronic. Now, the excited electronic state could look like this, in which case there's a continuum of states. And then if we bring this, if we make this vertical Frank-Condon transition, and now we look at the overlap with all the states, there's an overlap at every energy, and we get a spectrum that looks like this. So these ideas now of these theoretical tools for for electronic excitation and vibronic excitation are part of the core of theoretical chemistry, and in fact another Nobel Prize was given in 1971. Somebody named Gerhard Hertzberg got the Nobel Prize for his use of this information in order to understand molecular structures. Okay. So now let's go to the late 1980s and 1990s. These pictures are time independent.
Are those pictures drawn to scale?
In the sense of, is this energy separation? This could be a real, yes. I would say typically electronic excitations involve energies about 5 times larger than bond energies. So within a factor of 2 or 3, let's say. Okay. So Ahmed Zewail, who was in the chemistry faculty at Caltech in the late 1980s, did some work which he called clocking chemical reactions. And what he did was he instead of taking this time-independent viewpoint, he took a time-dependent viewpoint. He excited the molecule ICN with an ultra-short laser pulse. Ultra-short here meaning short compared with the vibrational time scale, which we now know is 10 to the minus 14th seconds or so, 10 to the minus 13th seconds. So he came in with a pulse that was, let's say, 10 times shorter than that. That makes a vertical transition here. But now because the pulse is an ultra-short pulse, it creates a non-stationary state. And this is a wave packet. The wave packet begins to move out. Now you can come in with a second pulse, and this is what Zewail did, to excite to a third surface, and then monitor the fluorescence from the surface, which is a measure of how much was excited here. Now, the absorption over here happens only after the wave packet has left this region and has gotten out to the region where the potential becomes a plateau. And therefore, the time scale for the onset of the fluorescence is a measure of the time it took for the wave packet to get from here to here. And that is the time it took for the I and the CN to separate far enough so that they no longer interacted significantly. And that is what he dubbed real-time clocking of chemical reactions, or femtochemistry. And there are literally thousands of papers since 1987 now on variations of these ideas, and it's gone from small molecules up to biological molecules. Let me tell you about one other experiment from the same era, which introduces the concept of interference. This experiment was done in 1991. By Shearer, Fleming, et al. And they came in with two pulses of light. First pulse of light created this non-stationary wave packet here, which moves out and eventually comes back. The motion of the wave packet in this kind of potential is fairly classical. At the time when the wave packet comes back, they excite again. So the first excitation, wave packet goes back, excite again. And what they were able to show was that they get interference between the wave packet that's already up and the new wave packet which is brought up. And that interference can be either constructive or destructive, depending on the phase of the second laser pulse relative to the first laser pulse. The phase of the light imprints itself on the phase of the wave packet, and therefore, by choosing 180 degree out of phase pulses, you can make destructive interference with the wave packet that's already up. And they observe this by monitoring the fluorescence from this excited state. Okay. So this is one disadvantage of blackboards over PowerPoint.
Have you ever tried to erase a PowerPoint?
Okay. Okay, now I started by saying that Arthur Shallow said a diatomic molecule is a molecule with one atom too many. And I disagree. A diatomic molecule is a molecule with one atom too few. And the reason is that now that we have these concepts about how to think about photochemistry and photoexcitation, now we want to turn to the problem of controlling which bond we break in a molecule. And instead of starting with those complicated molecules that we started here, let's take the simplest possible model for controlling bond breaking. Now, what is the simplest possible model? You need at least three atoms, because you have to, if you want to be able to show you can break this bond and not this bond, or this bond and not that bond, you need at least two bonds. So therefore, a triatomic molecule is the smallest case for which this problem can really be addressed. And I want to talk about a very simple cartoon mechanism for controlling the bond breakage. Excite this molecule. Because of the asymmetry here in the forces and the masses, this will vibrate. And at a certain time, the molecule in the excited state will look like this, with a large distance between A and BC. But because this thing is constantly in motion, at another time, there'll be a large distance between C and AB. And now I remind you something which to a certain extent many people didn't pay attention to, but the Frank Condon principle of the vertical transition, people very often take for granted that you only have to think about the coordinate space. But the momentum in this case becomes very, very important. So there's both the momentum, the coordinate and the momentum of the nuclei are preserved in making an upward and also a downward transition. So what we're going to do is we're going to come in with one pulse of light and set the molecule, excite the molecule electronically. The molecule will begin to vibrate. If we catch the molecule at one instant in time with a large separation and momentum going outward in this way, then we can break off A from BC. If we let the molecule go in the excited state for a longer period of time until C starts to go off, and again, we want the position and the momentum to be favorable, and then we bring this molecule back to the ground state, we can get C to break off from AB. So I'll show you another cartoon for this process. Now, this is really a multidimensional problem, but to keep things simple for now at least, I want to talk about a one-dimensional representation. So in this region, schematically, we have A plus BC. In this region, we have AB plus C. We start in the ground vibrational state of the parent molecule ABC. We make an electronic excitation. So that brings this wave packet up here. And this packet starts to move around back and forth. If we catch it at the right time and bring it down, the wave packet will move out this way. If we wait a different amount of time, let the packet move this way, bring it down, then we'll get this product. So what this suggests is that depending on the amount of time that the packet is able to move in the exciting state potential, that determines whether it goes out this way or this way. And the time that the packet is able to move in the excited state, we can control by the delay between two pulses, one which excites and one which stimulates emission back to the ground state. So we have a single control parameter here, which can give us control over which bond we break.
You've drawn it as if the A and BC and AB, you've drawn it as if those two configurations, A and BC and AB and C, have the same energy. Again, that's the only...
Okay, very good question. And I think, let me show you another way to view this, which will actually make the energetics a little bit clearer. Because real quantum control, the quantum control that's interesting is based on actually being able to select between states that have the same energy. Otherwise, you could use just frequency tuning. But if you can control, if you have states that are at the same energy and you want to select which one you get, that's really control. So let me show you, that'll become clear in another viewpoint of this. So I'm just going to give myself some space by doing this. So I have this scheme was. I developed with Rice in 1985, and Tanner, Kozloff, and Rice, 1986. And I have a colleague at who used to be my next door neighbor at the Weizmann Institute, Moshe Shapiro. He and Paul Brumer had an alternative viewpoint of how to control chemical reactions. And if I translate the same scheme into their language, it looks like this. So this corresponds to my ground state, my initial state, and this corresponds to AB plus C, and this corresponds to A plus BC. And now, in their viewpoint, the key is that I have two pathways to get from my initial state to my final state. If I have two pathways, then those pathways can interfere either constructively or destructively, depending on the phase with which they add. And similarly, let me just extend this a little bit. Similarly, I have two pathways to get to the other product. And so these will interfere constructively or destructively, depending on the phase. And now, if I translate this scheme into their language, when I excite with a broad pulse, and that creates a coherent superposition of these excited vibrational states. And then each one of these states evolves with its own phase factor. So this one evolves, has energy E1, this one has energy E2, etc. And now, depending on the time delay between, now a second pulse comes in and stimulates emission back down to the ground state. Depending on the time delay between this pulse, these two phases beat against each other and develop a relative phase which can be zero or can be 180. Depending if I choose the time that comes in here is the time delay between the pulses, so I can, by choosing the time delay properly, I can control the beating here to be anything between 0 and 180, and therefore get constructive here, destructive here, or constructive here, destructive here. This is exactly another way of saying this. Okay, but this is done in the language of time-independent quantum mechanics. This is the language of time-dependent quantum mechanics. This perspective is nice in the sense that it shows a kind of a connection with Feynman's sum over states formulation of quantum mechanics, because there's a sum over paths, except now instead of being a passive feature of quantum mechanics, it's an active feature. So given that this is a sum over path, control the phases of those paths by your external control, and then you can control the outcome. Okay, so what we saw in this scheme was two pulses and time delay. So we had just a single control parameter. But it's natural to ask, imagine that an experimentalist.
Has this been done? Before you go on,
I would say that all of the fundamental physics has been shown, but to actually control the bond breakage has not. But I would say that within the next few years the technology will be there. What's really needed is a broader spread of excitation frequencies, so a coherent tunable laser pulse with a broader.
And what kind of triatomic?
Okay, so I think the problems are as follows. Generally, for small molecules, they absorb in the ultraviolet, and then experimentalists don't like to work there because they can't see what they're doing, and the larger molecules that absorb in the visible, we know very little about the potential energy surfaces of them. But I think, for instance, the molecule OCS is an excellent candidate. It's known to have photochemical products of O plus CS or OC plus S, for instance. So I think once the technology reaches the right the level where it becomes convenient enough, I think there'll be innumerable examples, because almost every molecule should be able to be controlled this way.
So they do this with synchrotrons. UV can be readily accessible.
Yeah, but then, okay, what you need is you also need the ability to do, I'll talk right now about
time structure. Oh, they do this with synchrotron as well. They have this single branch mode, and they find time structure.
What I'm going to talk about right now, which is optimal control theory, goes to the next step, which is not just a two-pulse experiment, but actually being able to independently control. But it's true. If somebody, I'm not an experimentalist, but if an experimentalist had the sufficient motivation, they could probably show this now with synchrotron radiation. Okay. So
I'd like to ask one more question about that. If you just have these two levels as you drew, it's clear that they come in and out of phase as you wave time. But if you had many levels and they weren't regularly spaced, the recurrence time could become extremely long, exponentially long in the number of levels.
Okay.
So does this pose a problem? Or?
Okay, so here's my view on this, which is having many levels helps us, because if you take a wave packet picture, the more levels you have in your superposition, the more densely spaced they are, the more classical it is. So if you excite them, if you excite a coherent superposition, you create something which is very classical-like, which means it's localized in phase space, and you should have better control.
As long as the classical dynamics is
Now you can already see that actually these, if we view this as a solar system, all the issues of chaos come in, and then the quantum analog of classical chaos, and this has spurred a tremendous amount of work within the theoretical chemistry community for exactly these reasons. And once you put in an external field, now what are the properties of the chaos? Can chaos become regular and so forth? So there are many. I can't go up that road right now, but this is. This tends to be very classical, like at least chaos anyway is defined in terms of long time dynamics. And here what we're trying to do is we're trying to beat the time scale. I should have said this in the introduction. When people tried using very simple schemes in large molecules to control bond breakage, they just made the field stronger and stronger, tuned to a resonance of a particular bond. And that ended up giving completely random products, and the reason is that within the time scale of about 10 to the minus 12 or 10 to the minus 11 seconds, you have what very rapid intra-vibrational energy redistribution, and so that in a certain sense might be the analog of the classical chaos. But we're trying here within a couple of vibrational periods, which is a time scale where even if the system is chaotic, it doesn't yet know it, to control the bond breakage. Okay. So now imagine, let's let our imagination go wild, particularly if it's 1985, that an experimentalist could make an arbitrary electric field as a function of time. And it has an amplitude and a phase. We're going to treat this as a complex field. Then the question is, can you do better than what you would do with just two pulses with a time delay between them? And so in order to, there's an infinity of different possible pulse shapes. In order to sort out which ones we should be exploring, we formulate the problem mathematically to look for the best possible pulse shape. And that brings us to the calculus of variations. So what we have to do, now I'm going to draw the same process now, but in two dimensions. So here's, this coordinate is A plus BC, and this coordinate is AB plus C. All right, I spared you as long as I could from the diagrams that people who work in chemical dynamics use all the time. but these are now potential energy contours. This corresponds to a minimum of the ABC molecule. And here we have a saddle point. And if we get over this direction, we break into AB plus C. There's another saddle point here. If we get over in this direction, we've broken off A from BC. And now the excited state. Looks something like this. I didn't draw it too well, but if we now make a vertical transition, so imagine that that's vertical, then we have a two-dimensional wave packet now on this surface, and let me change colors, which executes a Lissajous type of motion. And now we can catch this wave packet at different times, bring it back down to the ground state. So this is just the same picture I was showing over there, but I'm showing it now in two dimensions. And now, depending on when we come down, the packet can exit out this way, or if we wait till the packet comes back here and we bring it back down, the wave packet can exit out that way. So this is the simplest possible model for controlling bond breakage, because we need at least two coordinates. And what this model does is it translates the problem of controlling bond breakage into the problem of steering a wave packet in two dimensions from its initial state to a particular outgoing channel. So that becomes the fundamental problem of controlling chemical reactions. And what we do to formulate the optimal pulse mathematically is that we define a projection operator. What the projection operator does is it throws away everything in the wave function except for the part that we want. So it's like a paper slicer that the secretary has in her office that chops away the part of the wave function you don't want and just keeps the part that you want. And so this defines a projection operator. Depending on whether we want to optimize this channel or that channel, we can give it a subscript. And we can now define mathematically an objective, J, if the entire wave function is normalized, then when we throw away part of it, the norm of the thing that's left is going to be less than 1. And we can define this object J, which now is a real number between 0 and 1. And this is the thing we want to maximize. Now J is a functional of the electric field. That's the claim. In other words, the electric field, E of t, determines psi at the final time. The final time here is just long enough so that the field is off and all the products have decided which direction they're going. So the electric field as a function of time determines the wave function at the final time. The wave function at the final time determines J. And therefore, the quantity J is a functional of E. And then the way to find the best possible shape of the electric field is to take the variation of J with respect to E and set it equal to 0. Okay? Now, in practice, what we usually have to do to regularize the problem is we have to define a modified objective functional, so which J bar, which is J with either some penalty or some Lagrange multiplier that takes into account the integrated energy in the electric field. And then this condition becomes delta J bar delta E is equal to zero. Okay? And why do we have to add something like that? The original work that we did was within second order perturbation theory. So the first interaction with the light takes you to the excited state, and the second interaction takes you back down. And now, if you don't put this in, then within perturbation theory, you find that you can make the objective larger and larger by simply increasing the field. Yeah. Lambda can either be fixed in advance, in which case it's called a penalty function, or you choose it as a Lagrange multiplier. When you get your equations for the field, you have a Lagrange multiplier here, which is undetermined at the beginning. It's determined at the end by the condition that this is equal to some fixed amount that you want. Okay. So, what's the time frame? Because it's already almost. Well, I guess the question is, I just wanted to talk about a couple of other things, but if it normally ends in an hour, then that 10 minutes is fine. Yeah. Okay. Great. Let me just see it too.
So do you have to calculate this optimum electric field for each particular molecule, or is it
something? Yes. Yes. I mean, the dream is that for every molecule known to man, you could dial in on the computer, let's say, in some kind of atlas, and pick the bond you want, and then it would tell you what the pulse shape that you need is. That's the optimal pulse, and then you'd go to the laboratory, and that would work. Yes. Yeah. In fact, for simple problems, one gets extremely close to one, and for more complicated problems, typical yields for these dissociative problems, our yields tend to be 70% or so until we get tired of iterating the procedure on the computer, but
you make other approximations, so it's not necessarily right to be visually accurate.
So you mean these pulses can't be taken directly into the laboratory, which is...
You've made all sorts of approximations in the way.
Right.
Which are not controlling.
Yeah, maybe one of the biggest ones is that if you're trying to get yield which is non-perturbative, then you need strong fields. But they don't have to be super strong, like some of the fields that we're going to hear about in our workshop. They don't have to be super strong, but they have to be strong enough that you can't not worry about multi-photon ionization and other higher-lying excited states. And that's certainly one of the main worries. I think the Frank-Condon approximation is not too much of a problem. We have some work from more than 10 years ago, which is, can you use strong fields to create a kind of a Rabi cycling between these two potentials to pump this wave packet up and dig it out, while at the same time choosing the field to turn off multi-photon, multi-photon ionization. And so these are all things that, that with control machinery become, you can ask these kinds of questions.
So is there a reason why in principle 100% yield is not attainable? I mean, is there a theoretical maximum yield for a given object, or is it just
okay, this is
hard to reach that?
Who asked the question? Oh, okay. There's a formal mathematical theory of controllability, and I'm just trying to think if I should skip right to that. But the theory of controllability, I'll use it up my precious 10 minutes. I'll use it for to tell you a little story. there's a chemist, a physicist, and a mathematician that are all staying at the same location, and a fire breaks out in the middle of the night. And the chemist wakes up and he smells the smoke and he goes to the bathroom and he fills a bucket after bucket of water and he pours the water over the fire until the fire goes out. The physicist wakes up, smells the smoke, he goes over to his desk, and he calculates exactly how many buckets he's going to need to fill. And he fills up exactly that many buckets, and when he pours the last bucket on the fire goes out. The mathematician wakes up and he smells the smoke, and he lies in bed and he thinks about the problem for a while. And then he goes to the bathroom and he turns on the faucet and he watches the water run for a while. And then he says, a solution exists. And he turns the water off and he goes back to sleep. Okay, so now, and the joke is actually very relevant to this work, because the two pulse sequence is a chemist approach. Right? It says here's a mechanism, it works. Right? When we try to optimize this using the calculus of variations, that's the physicist approach. We said let's calculate exactly how we should do this. And the theory of controllability, which is in a certain sense the one that mathematicians like. It doesn't even tell you what the control is. It just tells you that yes, there is a way of getting from this initial state to that final state, and that theory is based. It's for those of you who know something about Lie algebras, it's interesting. So I'll just talk about this maybe, and then I'll. So if the Hamiltonian has a bare part and it has a control times another piece, and this could actually be a sum, there could be others, then what you do is you look at the iterative commutators. And when you iterate the commutators, you find that they span the full space of if these are n by n matrices, n by n Hermitian matrices, and by iterating the commutators, you can get the full space of n by n Hermitian matrices. Then that's the criterion for being completely controllable. And the concept behind the iterative commutators is that it actually comes from something in dynamical theory known as Chow's theorem from the 1930s, I believe. In dynamical theory, it's actually something bad that these commutators keep propagating, because if you're trying to solve a dynamical system, you want it to be, it's easier to solve it if it lives in only a reduced subspace. The more commutators you have, the more this thing explores different directions in the space. In quantum control, if you want controllability, it's the opposite. Then it's good to have many iterative commutators, because you want to be able to explore every possible direction in the space. So if these commutators continue, The basic idea of the commutator is that it comes from the idea that if you go forward under this, and then forward under this, and then backward under this, and then backward under this, then you can generate to leading order this object. So then if you have these two at your disposal, you can generate the commutator by going forward and backward. It's a little bit more subtle because H0, you can go forward, but you can't go backwards. So this leads to a whole literature about how to handle the H0 in these treatments. So,
you actually really want chaotic
system. Yeah, you want chaotic, and that's right. In the language of Lie algebras, it has to be compact also, because otherwise you don't come back. So in other words, if you go under H0 long enough, you're going to come back to where you started from, if it's compact. So let me just take a couple of more minutes, and I promised in the title of the talk to talk about cooling and computing. I'm not going to do justice to either one, but I will just try to give you the headlines of both of those.
Can I ask one question to this? Can you turn the table in the sense that if your Hilbert space is not finite, then it is definitely not controllable?
Okay, good question. So these proofs, I should have said that. These proofs are all for finite level systems.
For finite dimensional Hilbert
spaces? Finite dimension. The proofs. Now, what we have in the case of molecular dissociation is we have a continuum. And so finite and discrete. What we have is a continuum, and not only that, what we really, and it's also infinite and degenerate. So the chemistry begins where mathematics ends. That's really, so the mathematicians, when I've gotten to a number of control conferences where there are chemists or physicists and mathematicians, and the mathematicians are actually fascinated by the problem of the infinite and the continuum. And also we're interested in systems with dissipation and so forth where the mathematical theories don't apply.
So the summary is that for a real atomic system, we don't really know if in principle you can achieve 100% yield with a carefully designed signal or not.
Atomic, molecular. I would say that's true. I think it might be a doable mathematical problem, but the mathematical proofs that I've seen, I haven't convinced me, because in the end there's always a little, you know, and then a miracle occurs. Okay, so just very quickly about cooling. If you want to cool something down, so let's see. If you want to cool something down, so you imagine that you have some histogram of populations. And if you want to cool it down, you want to get everything into the lowest possible level. Okay? That would be cooling. Now, in order to describe this, though, there are many. You start off with many populations, but these are not coherent. And so, in order to describe the initial state, you need a density matrix. And the simplest case would just be a 2x2 density matrix, where these are the populations. So A plus D equals 1, and these are the coherences. So B times C is less than or equal to A times D, and therefore we could define a proportionality constant, gamma. So the coherences are here, and for a typical initial thermal state, these are zero. So you have rho is AD. And what we learned after many years of working on the cooling process using optimal control was that you don't have to get into this state in order to be cold. If you can get into a state which is very energetic, but is a single state, then it's very easy by control to move it to here. That's the easy part. The hard part is to get this distribution into a single state. And you can even be in a broad distribution, like this, but if it's coherent, then we know by coherent control or by quantum control how to get that into the lowest state. The hard part is to take an incoherent distribution and turn it into a coherent distribution. So this leads to a fascinating control problem. How do you take an incoherent distribution and turn it into a coherent distribution? And it turns out that if you try to do it by complicated pulse shaping, you get no progress at all. In other words, there's a certain, you can either use the von Neumann entropy or the purity or some other measure of where you start from. You can do all kinds of manipulations with coherent fields, but you can't make it colder, and you also can't make it hotter. So in order to actually cool, and we know that you can, there is such a thing as laser cooling, you need dissipation. And now you have this irony that you need dissipation in order to get to your target. But if you only had the dissipation with no control, then you would get heating instead of cooling. What would determine whether you got heating or cooling? So you have this very interesting interplay between the part of the process which is controllable and the part which is uncontrollable. And in a certain sense, so I like to describe it in a couple of ways. One of them is that it's as if you have two buttons. One of them is the button that does what you want, but you're only allowed to press the other button. Okay. Another way to view it, which maybe is also, I think, a little entertaining, is that you can only control cooling. You can't directly control it by your shaped pulse, by your laser pulse. Your pulse does something to the system, so that then the dissipation after that does what you want. But you can think about it as the process of controlling having grandchildren. Now, so if you have a certain amount of control over having children. But how do you control having grandchildren? The only way to do it is that you try to control as much as you can in the first step, so that the second step will come out the way that you want. Okay. So these ideas of controlling cooling, since cooling is related to coherence, these ideas I think have very interesting interplay with control of decoherence, and also I think that what we're still missing is a comprehensive thermodynamics that quantifies how much coherence, what are the limitations on the ability to manipulate coherence when you have interaction of light matter systems or other kinds of systems with quantum mechanical coherence, and control gives us a handle to study that problem, because when you can't control something, then there's some kind of restriction which has the status of a kind of a thermodynamic law. So I think maybe this is a good place to stop before I run out of my welcome. So.
We have a few minutes more for questions. This is where quantum computing comes in.
I just decided that I'd be better off stopping. But the quantum issue. This is related. The quantum. Here we have. For the density matrix, we define an objective which is something like this. So J would be the trace of rho and some desired operator here, which is let's say the ground state. So this would be the objective for cooling. And then I didn't really say it very clearly, but when you formulate an optimal control problem, you need three things. You need an objective, you need a control, and you need an equation of motion. So, in principle, given these three things, you can set up a control problem. So this would be the control problem. Cooling would be typically, this would be the objective. The control is that you have some control over the density matrix by the electric field. You have an equation of motion for the density matrix. Now, for the case of quantum computing, you would, you define, the central object in quantum computing is to create a desired quantum gate, which is really just a unitary operator. So you, what you want to do is you want to define the unitary operator that you actually want, and then you, and then this is the unitary operator that you actually produce, where U depends on the electric field. In other words, the electric field determines what unitary you actually produce, and then there's an overall phase that that can't be controlled. So this is, I call this the trout objective. But, all right, so you want to make this as close as possible to the desired. And then you need an equation, so you need a control, which you have, because this depends on the electric field, but you need an equation of motion, and we know the equation of motion for the unitary operator. It's an evolution operator, which is just, which just obeys the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. So we have all the ingredients. And using these methods of optimal control can be applied to building quantum unitary gates. Yeah?
If you have an incomplete system, you want a complete control over, can you show in general whether or not you can add a term to the Hamiltonian that will allow you to get complete control?
That's a very good question. I have a paper that's a little bit related to that subject that's just in press now in Israel. Let me see if this is your question, because this is what was bothering me. If these commutators don't span the entire space, but they stop at a certain point, can one say something about what do we have? What states can be reached, let's say? What controls are missing in order to be able to span the full space? And so what we found is that there are two classes of uncontrollable systems that hadn't been previously categorized. And it's well known in Lie algebra, but it wasn't known in control theory. There are reducible and irreducible uncontrollable systems. And the reducible ones are ones where there are states where you can't get any transfer at all. You can find states that you can't get any transfer to at all. And the irreducible ones are for any two states you can produce some transfer. But I think there are many open questions still about the combining. Or I would say the interplay between the Lie algebraic structure and the physics, because behind all the Lie algebra commutators, there's always a very interesting physics if you look for it. So for instance, dark states have some connection to things that are missing here in the Lie algebraic structure.
Is it possible to influence bond formation with stimulated emission?
So this is bond formation. This is called photoassociation, and this is now. There's been a lot of work on this in the last 10 years, basically it works like. I'm not sure I'm going to draw this very well, but. You have two cold atoms that are coming in. Because they're cold, they're traveling very, very slowly. And so when this wave function gets in close, you kind of pump up and simulate emission back down. Some of the schemes relied on spontaneous emission, but I think it's now well established that simulated emission works here. And then there's been recent work on showing how you can stabilize these products and get them down to the ground.
Okay, let's thank David again for this.